Welcome to the eve of Rohatsu Sesshin, celebration of Buddha's awakening. Which, of course, we celebrate by enacting the Buddha's awakening through the practice of Zazen for 7 days until this time next week. And over the course of this week, I know many of you are sitting a day or multiple days, but you're all welcome to come and join in Zazen anytime throughout the day. This time next week, we'll culminate the Sesshin with a ceremony to celebrate Buddha's awakening at 5 o'clock, and then this time at 6:30, we'll have a Dharma inquiry ceremony with the Shuso, the head student, Reverend Mushin, Dream Forest, will take up the staff and respond to questions from the Dragon and Elephant Assembly. It's you all. Please come if you can and make the ceremony with your sincere questions. That ceremony for the Shuso begins with her bringing up an old case, an old Zen story from the collections of Zen stories, and they kind of set the stage for the questioning. So the questions may have nothing to do with it, that Zen story, but they can, if you like. It might stir your heart's creative juices to inquire into the story. But also your question can just be anything that's most dear to your heart, about the heart of your practice. Look, there's an old Zen tradition of some days before this Shuso Dharma inquiry ceremony, the practice period leader bringing up the case, the story that will be brought up in the ceremony and commenting on it. So I'll do that now. This ceremony is usually begins with this story of Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. And Emperor Wu asking Bodhidharma who he is, and Bodhidharma saying he doesn't know. But, you know, this doesn't have to be based on that story. In my Shuso ceremony at Tassajara, I asked my teacher, could I bring up a different story instead of that one? I've heard that Bodhidharma story so many times, and of course it never runs out of its wonders. But I asked if I could just bring up a different one. He said, okay. So we brought up a different story. So this year I asked Dream Forest if she'd like to use that Bodhidharma story or bring up another one. And so she said also, how about another one? I said, well, what story? And so she suggested this one. And I said, okay. case 40 in the Blue Cliff Record, which is also case 91 in the Book of Serenity. So I brought along our Book of Serenity tonight. In the Blue Cliff Record, it's called Nan Chuan's Like a Dream. And in the Book of Serenity, it's called Nan Chuan's Peony. Peony.
The flower.
Peony. Probably a Chinese peony. I couldn't help Google imaging peony, and it showed up a photo of a Chinese peony. They're bright. Also, I think it's coincidentally, I think, kind of auspicious that she happened to choose this case, because I recall, maybe it was even the first time I ever came to Santa Cruz Zen Center. I wasn't living in Santa Cruz. I was living at Green Gulch Farm or Tassajara, and I was just coming to visit and gave a talk on a Wednesday night about this story, Nan Chuan's Peony. I even tried, like, looking back in all those archives on the web, and I couldn't find it. It might be on a CD or something. But I remember being struck by this bright pink flower bush in front of the Zendo as I walked in that evening. So here's the story. Officer Lu Gong said to Nan Chuan, his Zen teacher, Dharma Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. He was able to say, quote, heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one substance, one essence, one body. Amazing, huh? He said to his teacher. And Nan Chuan pointed to a peony in the garden and said, people today see this flower as in a dream. So a little bit of the background, like the characters in the story. Lu Gong was it says officer here. He was a member of the, translated here as Supreme Court in Tang Dynasty China, whatever that was. But a layperson involved in government, which is a nice example that in these early days of Zen in China, there were very sincere lay practitioners with very busy lives in government that still had time to look into the teachings and meet with the Zen teachers and practice Zazen. So a previous encounter between these two, Officer Liu and Nan Chuan, was that one time he asked Nan Chuan, I've raised a goose inside a bottle, and gradually it grew too big to get out. So now, without damaging the bottle or injuring the goose, how would you get it out? Not going to be easy. It's definitely a good question. Nan Chuan called him. Officer Liu. Liu said, yes. Nan Chuan said, it's out. So it's a nice prelude to this main case here, I think, because this dilemma, we have dilemmas like this, right? How can we get the goose out of the bottle without breaking the bottle or hurting the goose? It's a dilemma. We're either going to have to break the bottle or hurt the goose. There must be another way. We feel stuck in this dilemma. And we can think about it until the geese come home, trying to figure out what to do about this dilemma. But at the moment, the officer's called as he's contemplating this dilemma, what to do. Officer Liu. Yes? I would imagine that at the time he said yes, that the dilemma was not torturing his mind at that moment. Therefore, the goose is out and in good health. The bottle's shiny and unscathed. And it says that Officer Liu had some awakening at this moment when his teacher said, the goose is out and it's fine. So after this, probably after this happened, he had some awakening, but interestingly, he got really into studying Dharma after some insight. He wanted to plumb the depths. He wanted to understand more. He wanted to clarify the details. So he was, it says, he concentrated on the nature of inner reality, perusing the treatises of Song Zhao. Song Zhao is a like, 4th century Dharma teacher in China, disciple of Kumarajiva, the great translator. So this was, the 4th century was before Zen in China, a century or so before Bodhidharma came. So early Dharma teaching in China before Zen. But Song Zhao had a kind of a, like a Zen kind of spirit. He wrote about the Mahayana and emptiness, Prajnaparamita, and his treatise became well known. And part of his treatise is called Nirvana Has No Name, or Nirvana is Ineffable. Nirvana cannot be named, even though it's named Nirvana. It doesn't really fit into that word. So there's this a treatise by that name where it says, the line that he quoted, but the fuller version of this treatise says, the mysterious way is in ineffable insight. You know, ineffable, it's a nice Zen word. Ineffable means like unspeakable, like you can't say it because you can't conceive of it. The mysterious way is in ineffable insight. Insight is in unification with the ultimate. Unification with the ultimate involves seeing existence and non-existence as equal. And when you see them equally, then self and others are not two. Therefore, heaven, earth, and I have the same root. The myriad things and I are one body, one substance, one essence. Being the same as me, they're no longer existent or non-existent. If they were different from me, that would make comprehension impossible. neither beyond nor within, being or non-being, the way resides in between, in the middle. So that's the treatise is much longer than that too, but this commentator, Wan Song, couldn't help quoting that much of it. And so Officer Liu thought these particular lines were just wonderful. These lines, heaven, earth, and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one substance, a body. Interesting, these two lines were also once brought out by this conversation between Fa Yan and Gui Chen. They were talking about this treatise of Song Zhao. And when they got to the point where it says, heaven, earth, and I have the same root, Chen asked Fa Yan, are the mountains, rivers, and earth identical to yourself or different? And Fa Yan said, they're different. And Kui Chen held up two fingers like this. Like. In Zen, sometimes in Zen, they hold up one finger. Right? One old Zen teacher, every time anyone would ever ask him anything, he would just hold up one finger. So that's like unity, non-differentiation. Right? So this is kind of like, almost like, maybe almost like a no-no or something in Zen, this two-finger thing. Duality, separation, division, ding, 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 two. So, are mountains, rivers, and earth identical to yourself or different? Fa Yan said, they're different. Gui Chen's held up two fingers. So then Fa Yan immediately said, oh, identical. And Chen again held up two fingers. Yeah. Separate? Identical. You know, it's too late here, really. I think the conversation's ruined. So Chen actually just got up and left the room. That's another story about this treatise of Song Zhao. You know, the Zen people, once Zen started, they sometimes were a little bit critical of so-called treatises that weren't directly expressing the immediacy of Zen. You know, like in Zen, there's just holding up a flower directly, and Mahakashyapa, seeing the Buddha holding up a flower, smiles. No treatise in addition to this needs to be expounded. But there are Buddhist treatises, and even one of our direct ancestors, Shuto Sekito Kisen, had some awakening also when reading this treatise of Song Zhao, the Zhao Nun. A different part. Sekito Kisen read this part. Kind of similar, though. The ultimate person is completely empty, with no form. Yet, of all the myriad things, there is none that is not her own making or her own doing? Who can understand myriad things as oneself? Only a sage. And Shurto had some awakening when he heard that, when he read that, and said to himself, a sage has no self, yet there is nothing that's not himself. This is very similar to the myriad conversations we've been having on Sunday mornings, all about the self, and the true self and the not self. This is, that whole class series could be summed up in this line of Shurto, Sekito Kisen. A sage has no self, no separate self, yet there is nothing that is not herself, her true self. Then he wrote The Merging of Difference and Unity, which we chant, which we chanted this morning. So the officer said to Nantuan, this Dharma Master Zhao was able to say, heaven and earth and I have the same root, myriad things and I are one substance. Isn't that marvelous and extraordinary? And Nantuan pointed to a peony in the garden and said, people today see this flower as in a dream. I personally almost never remember my dreams at night when I wake up. And I think that it may be partly because we get up too early around here. I've heard for good, like, clear dreaming and lucid dreaming and so on, it's good to get a lot of sleep. And that twilight hours when you're naturally starting to wake up, that's when the clearest dreams happen. So, never get the chance around here for clear dreams. Anyway, I hardly ever remember. But this morning, I happened to wake up remembering a vivid, clear dream where something like my brother and I were at some school or something, and we wanted to go home, and I just had this bike, and I said, you can ride on the bike with me if you want. And I think he wasn't so thrilled about that. He was hoping that we'd have a car to go home in. We were looking at a map, and it was a long, long way home on this map. But, well, this is what we have. You're welcome to, you know, ride in the back of the bike here. And so he, okay. So we started off riding towards home, and then I remembered that I forgot something back where we started at the school. I don't know, we just maybe gotten half a mile or something. And we have a long way to go and we're still pretty close. Let me just go back and pick up whatever it was that I forgot. So I left him in the bike there and just kind of ran back to the school, and I got whatever it was that I left behind. And then there was some kind of volumes of books there in the entrance of the school, and I picked something up and I started reading it, and this is amazing. And I was going through like a couple volumes of this reading, getting so totally involved in it. And then at some point I remembered, like, oh wait, my brother's waiting out there on the bike. It's been like hours, or what it felt like hours in the dream. And I got totally lost in these books. So, I think then I woke up. When I was practicing in Japan at Bukokuji Monastery, my teacher there, Tongen Harada Roshi, was kind of critical of Zen people reading treatises, reading anything really, even reading Zen stuff. I think especially the foreigners who would come, maybe half of the monastery were people who weren't from Japan but from around the world. And he said, if you made it all the way to Japan from whatever your country is to practice Zen, you've already read enough. That was what he would say. And so just sit and practice and listen to his dharma, but don't get involved in reading, because that was his own practice he had done apparently for a few years. He decided to take up the practice. I think he was really into maybe treatises too. So he decided to take up this practice. I'm not going to read any letters smaller than this, about like 6 inches. In other words, so if I'm out on my alms rounds or something and I'm getting lost, I'm allowed to read street signs. Because they have big letters. But anything smaller than that, like, I don't need to. So he kind of, that was his spirit, and he suggested that to others, and it was kind of hard for, I think I still snuck a little reading in here and there, because I love it, but not much that year. That was his style, just practice directly and straightforwardly, and don't get involved in conceptual thinking, even good Zen conceptual thinking. And then sometime later, I was back with my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, at Green Gulch, and after spending a lot of time reading treatises and studying Dharma, and I asked him, I think it was maybe influenced by this time in Japan with Tangen Roshi, and I asked Tenshin Roshi, you know, what do you think? You know, I do a lot of Dharma study, and sometimes I wonder if maybe I should just go on like a Dharma fast, and like not, you know, take a little break from studying Dharma and just sit and for a while. What do you think? And he said, actually, I think you should keep studying. So different kinds of teachers, right? And so I was somewhat relieved that he said that, because I actually love to study Dharma. It turns my mind, actually. And although I wondered, I still in my heart thought maybe it would be good to just take a break. But that was, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. And I have studied Dharma a lot since then, and I've done a lot of sitting since then too, and things like Sesshin, we do less study. And from this place now, looking back, I don't regret it at all. That Dharma study, I feel like, has completely transformed my actual sitting meditation. It's like if I was where I was at when I asked him that whether I should stop or not, that would be scary. I think I would just be like kind of sitting there and just, you know, trying to be present and trying to let go of conceptual thinking. But the way things are turned and view and understanding of how things are gets turned by Dharma. I don't think necessarily this comes to us during Zazen. It might sometimes. But if we just leave it in the conceptual presentations of Dharma and think that's a nice teaching and it makes sense conceptually and it satisfies our intellectual desires, then that's not really what it's about either. Right? So I think both. For these Zen people do study these treatises, but in this case, it looks like Nan Chuan was emphasizing to Officer Liu, that is actually a beautiful, marvelous teaching. It's, to me personally, I think it's one of the best. Heaven, earth, and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. But it's still comes surrounded by quotation marks. It's still a, it still comes packaged in this, these words. So Nanchuan pointed to the flower and said, people these days see this flower as in a dream. The flower could be Sung Jiao's treatise, this Dharma flower of beautiful presentation of ultimate unity. But people see this flower as in a dream. It sounds good, but how to really directly taste the truth of the Tathagata's words? Or we could see it, he's really just talking about this flower. People see these ordinary appearances in the world, think that we're seeing them directly, but actually we're actually seeing them kind of like in a dream. We're seeing them as maybe not ourself. From the treatise of Sung Jiao point of view, if we see a flower as something over there, then it's not ourself. It might be somehow in relation to ourself, but it's not ourself. It's not like we are the same substance or essence. People today, I think we could say, I really mean you, Officer Liu, see this flower as in a dream. I heard that Suzuki Roshi once said something like, to call a flower beautiful is a sin. It's kind of a strict teaching. No, I tried to find that teaching and I couldn't find it. So there might have been, but I think it's just strictly speaking, you know, to label this as some way that it is and say it like that it's a small sin, you know. There's much greater sins in this world, but it's instead of to just like look at this flower and be this flower, and it's actually beyond beautiful and ugly. It's just, it's beyond magnificent and ordinary. It's, what can we say? Anything we say is starting to maybe sin. But especially to kind of like judge it as beautiful.
Do you mind if I know you're giving your talk, so I just wait?
Yeah, why don't you wait? Let's keep moving along here. But I think one thing we could ask about this treatise is, if heaven and earth and I have the same root, myriad things are one, and I are one body, what is this root? That's, I think, the center of this statement. What is this root that we share? This source that we share? What is this, one body, one substance, one essence that the myriad things and I share? It's easy to speak of it, but how to be that and appreciate that fully. So that's really, I could say, what our practice is about. And maybe one way we could approach it is to hear someone say, people today see this flower as in a dream. And another way is in the commentary here, the commentator to this ancient koan quotes this poem, a little bit of a poem of Wang Wei, one of the old Tang Dynasty great poets. And Here's the whole poem. In my middle years, I became quite fond of the way and have made my home in the foothills of South Mountain. When the spirit moves me, I go off by myself to see things that I alone must see. I follow the stream to the source, and sitting there, I watch where the clouds rise up. Or, by chance, I may meet a woodsman, and we talk and laugh and forget all about going home. So the line of the poem that gets quoted here is, I follow the stream to the source, and sitting there I watch where the clouds rise up. There's this stream of thoughts going, streaming through the day, right? There's a stream of experience, like a raging river, from the moment we're born to the moment we die. And we're flowing along with the stream. But sometimes we might like to take a hike upstream. All this stream that's is flowing from the source. Moment to moment, it's flowing from the source. And we can walk upstream to the source. The root. We can trace back the radiance of this stream to its source. And sit there, sit here, and watch where the clouds pile up, where the clouds rise, where all this stuff is rising at the source of the stream. We can sit and watch that place where the stuff of our lives rises up and sinks back down. We can try to sit at the source, at this root, at this one body that's the source of me and you and the myriad things. And where we can watch me and you and the myriad things rise up at the source, from the source, this ineffable, mysterious source. If we seem to get a hold of the source in some way and seem to, okay, there, I got it. It's like it's a jewel I can pick up in my hand or something. Well, then that's just another cloud rising up at the source. This source can't ever be seen, but we can sit there. We can sit here where I and heaven and earth all arise. From the one source, as the one source, as one body, as one substance. What is the substance from which me, you, and the myriad things are made? The one substance. Some might say, aren't we made of stardust? But I think stardust is more stuff that's coming up from the source. What's the source of stardust? What's the substance of stardust? The one body from which stardust, me, you, the mountains, rivers, and the great earth all arise and cease back into. People see this flower as in a dream. So Dogen has an essay called Expressing a Dream Within the Dream. And he says, the place where the dream is expressed, where the dream is expounded, where the dream is taught, within a dream, is the land of Buddhas and Zen ancestors. Every dewdrop in every realm is a dream. This dream is the glowing clarity of the hundred grasses. The hundred grasses, the myriad trees, the thousand rocks, tiles, and pebbles, the 10,000 dancing chickens, all are their glowing clarity is this dream. So the Buddhas and ancestors don't speak outside the dream, and they can't really say anything other than dream talk. So it's another twist on people today see this flower as in a dream. Well, of course they do. How do you see a flower other than in a dream? But those who have some awakeness about dreams are Buddhas, and those who dream about awakening are sentient beings. So Buddhas can know a dream as a dream. And appreciate it as such. Richard, did you want to mention something?
It was only apropos of that moment.
Yeah, it does seem like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything is just apropos of a moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This moment, hypothetically, a Buddha sees the dream as a dream. What's that like?
Seeing the dream as a dream is not taking any experience as simply what it appears to be. Yarno.
And the San Joaquin River was getting smaller and smaller and becoming a little, very small stream. And sort of the source becomes very, like, there is no, like, one source. There's all these hillsides that are, have all their little streams that are flowing into this and then eventually through creating this river. But it was really and you know, I could have kept on going up and up and up, and at some point maybe there would have been like, you know, water coming out of just the rocks, like the source spring or whatever. But like, where does that come from? And then the imagery of the clouds. Well, often when you're kind of in places like that, you'll see clouds just sort of spontaneously form. I mean, even here, and then disappear. And this seemingly it's a cloud and then it's vapor that you can't see anymore.
So yes.
It's sort of very mysterious.
Yes, the clouds arise in myriad shapes and forms and then they disperse back into sky. And you know, we can sit where at the source of the stream and watch that happening. Yeah, and you're right that we can't really actually find the source. It's, if we could go right through the stream and kind of pinpoint it, it's like that point is the source. But it's never quite like that. The closer we get to it, the less it's there. And but yet to sit at the source, it's different from sitting downstream where the river's like rushing by, and we're kind of like getting like all wet with the flowing experience of our life. It's very kind of like, it's very tranquil also at the source of the stream, which later will become a raging river, but the source is very still. So, yes?
I'm curious how you would interpret your dream.
Well, I'm not an expert dream interpreter, but I think I am, such a thing could easily happen to me. That someone's waiting for me, and I'm totally absorbed in some treatise, and so then I in the dream I actually felt a little bit bad, actually, when I kind of remembered that my brother was waiting down there with the bike, like, oh, I totally forgot, I become distracted, but then it was also kind of a beautiful thing to wake up from that dream and realize it was just a dream of reading this treatise. In fact, I have no idea what it was even about. I don't even know if it was Dharma or what, but what it was about and why it was so interesting, but like, it was just a dream. So part of my interpretation of the dream is to appreciate that it was a dream. So,
do you take guidance from your dreams at all?
Well, like I say, I hardly ever remember them. So, but I might take the clue, two clues from that dream. One is to not get too carried away in treatises, and the other is to remember when I'm getting carried away in treatises, this is part of the dream. So I'll give that advice to myself, twofold advice. So it's about time, but do you have a quick one?
Oh, the valence of green, the word green in the text, in the case that you read us about seeing the green as in a dream, how are we to understand what's around the word green?
Yeah, and is it a negative thing? Mm-hmm. Or as Dogen says, which he often turns things around, seems like it's kind of a positive thing. Mm-hmm. If we can remember that it's always a dream and there's no waking up from this dream, then it's a little different than feeling like we're awake and therefore we know what's going on. Yeah, that seems like it's sort of implied there, that there's some non-dream way of being with the peony. But Dogen might argue with that. Or it might just be, people see this as in a dream, but they don't recognize that it's a dream. They think that they're really seeing it directly. That would be another way to hear it. So just to close, because today is Suzuki Roshi's annual memorial, which we celebrated this morning. He's been sitting so patiently on the altar here. And I just think this is a beautiful piece that Suzuki Roshi says about Sung Jiao's treatise. He doesn't say that, but the one substance, the one essence, the one body from which I and the myriad things are made, the root of heaven, earth, and you and me. He says, In our practice, we rely on something great and sit in that great space. The pain you have in your legs or some other difficulty is happening in that great space. As long as you do not lose the feeling that you're in the realm of Buddha nature, you can sit even though you have some difficulty. When you want to escape from your difficulty or when you try to improve your practice, you create another problem for yourself. But if you just exist there, then you have a chance to appreciate your surroundings and you can accept yourself completely without changing anything. That's our practice. To exist in big mind is an act of faith, which is different from the usual faith of believing in a particular idea or being. It's to believe that something is supporting us. I would add in, something is our root. Something is our true body, our true substance. Something is supporting us. And supporting all our activities, including thinking mind and emotional feelings and reading treatises and things like this. All these things are supported by something big that has no form or color. It's impossible to know what it is, but something exists there. Something that's neither material nor spiritual. Something like that always exists, and we exist in that space. That's the feeling of pure being, he says, and not always so. So, see you all in Sishin. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.